This is VOA News. Here I'm Marissa Melton. Brazil approved two vaccines for emergency use against the coronavirus on Sunday as the country's death toll from COVID-19 neared 210,000. That's according to the Brazilian Health Ministry. Brazil approved emergency use of vaccines from both Britain's AstraZeneca and China's Sinovac Biotech Limited. Hours later, a nurse in Sao Paulo was inoculated with a Chinese vaccine known as CoronaVac. Meanwhile, in Manaus, the largest city in the Amazon, hospital employees described to the Associated Press having to choose which patients to provide with oxygen as supplies in the remote city have dwindled. Brazil has also recorded cases of a new variant of the virus that is potentially more contagious than previous strains. Pakistan also announced Sunday that it had approved the AstraZeneca vaccine for emergency use. The South Asian country has confirmed nearly 520,000 cases of the virus. Britain announced Sunday it plans to have every adult in the country, roughly 51 million people, inoculated by September. In the United States, Los Angeles County in California became the first U.S. county to record 1 million COVID-19 cases. The news of the number of infections is compounded by the confirmation of the appearance in the county of the highly contagious British variant of the coronavirus. The United States has recorded the highest number of cases and deaths from the coronavirus anywhere in the world, with nearly 24 million cases and nearly 400,000 deaths since the beginning of the pandemic. You can follow this story and all the stories we're covering at our website, voanews.com. From Washington, this is VOA News. Police and National Guard troops are standing sentry at newly fortified state houses in the United States as small groups of armed demonstrators gather. The increased security at state capitals ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration comes as authorities work to deter a repeat of the January 6th riot that overran the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. A few protesters gathered in some cities Sunday, including some carrying large guns. But streets remained empty around many other state capitol buildings. Some protesters supported President Donald Trump, but others expressed general anti-government sentiments. Though FBI had warned of the potential for armed protest at state capitol buildings, there were no immediate reports of violence on Sunday. Russian opposition activist Alexei Navalny was detained upon his arrival in Moscow on Sunday. It was his first time back in his home country since he was poisoned last August and evacuated to Germany for treatment. Traveling back from Germany, Navalny was detained by police in black masks while entering passport control at the Moscow airport. His lawyer, who was traveling with him, was not allowed to accompany him. His whereabouts are not immediately known. This has prompted the hashtag Where's Navalny to trend on Russian Twitter. Navalny went to Germany for treatment after he was poisoned in August with a Soviet-era military-grade nerve agent while traveling in Siberia. He has openly accused President Vladimir Putin of ordering Russia's security services to carry out the attack. The Kremlin says it is not responsible. Roughly 100 Honduran migrants were met with tear gas and struck by police with batons when they tried to pass through a roadblock on the border with Guatemala. The group of migrants were part of a group of roughly 2,000 Hondurans who stopped Saturday night behind the roadblock. The majority stayed behind Sunday morning when the clashes between some members of their group and the police began. None of the migrants made it through the roadblock. Hundreds of migrants later sat in the roadway, refusing to move and attempting to appeal to Guatemalan authorities as fellow Central Americans. The Associated Press reported that many migrants showed visible injuries from batons after the clash. At least 9,000 migrants from Honduras had crossed into Guatemala on Saturday in a caravan that began one day earlier, hoping to reach the United States in the early days of the new presidential administration. The Guatemalan government issued a statement Saturday calling on Honduran authorities to, quote, contain the massive departure of its inhabitants through permanent preventive actions. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton from Washington. You're listening to VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, January 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's Bobi Wine rejects election results and calls on Ugandans to do the same.
The Electoral Commission was not and continues not to be in charge of this election. It was the military that was determining everything that was being relayed. We therefore reject the results of this election.
Meanwhile, Uganda's Electoral Commission says the courts are open for all aggrieved candidates. Violence marked the 10th anniversary of the Tunisian uprising. A Liberian talk show radio host is defiant as the government bans his show. And the DRC marks the 60th anniversary of Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
If this wasn't a reality, Congo would explode. The spirit of Lumumba is very strong and it plays a key role in our national unity.
And the Gambian government bans chickens and poultry products from Senegal. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Robert Chakulai, popularly known as Bobi Wine, has rejected the results of last Thursday's presidential election because of what he calls widespread illegalities and irregularities. Wine is calling on all Ugandans and the international community to do the same. He says his party has video evidence to prove their case, including ballot stuffing by the Ugandan military, which he said was also ordering people to vote for President Museveni on election day. Bobi Wine says he will present the evidence to the world as soon as the internet is restored in Uganda. He says he is under house arrest with more than 400 soldiers surrounding his house.
Well, James, as you know, on the eve of the election, it was a military operation to arrest all our polling agents and confiscate all the documents, including letters of appointment for them and all the money that we're using for facilitation. Now, before the election, General Museveni ordered for a complete shutdown of the internet to ensure that the world is not watching and Uganda is kept in the dark. And that means, therefore, on the day of the election, General Museveni and his lieutenants had a field day. The military was everywhere, stuffing critics, ballot papers, and stopping some people from taking part in the election. Therefore, there was widespread irregularities and illegalities. We therefore reject the results of this election with the contempt that it deserves. As soon as the internet is restored, we are going to show the world the evidence of our claim to victory. We therefore called upon the people of Uganda and continue calling upon them and the people of the world to reject the result that was fabricated by General Museveni and his lieutenants trying to undermine the will of the people of Uganda.
Do you plan to go to the courts of Uganda to make your case?
Everybody knows that the courts, the judiciary of Uganda is undermined by General Museveni. It is a mockery. It is firmly in the pocket of General Museveni. However, we have mentioned it that we have every nonviolent and every peaceful option on the table, and that also includes peaceful protest against this usurpation. But we also look at calling upon the developing partners and citizens of the world and all the donors and the people that wish Uganda well not to recognize the Museveni imposition of himself on the people of Uganda.
Your movement won some seats in parliament. I would say that was a success. What do you make of the performance of your party in parliament?
Well, it is rather weird that our party members won massively, even though the majority of them actually had much more results. The member of parliament results were relayed, but the presidential results were not relayed. And that disturbs everybody. I'm not allowed to talk about that. As we speak right now, I am under house arrest. More than 400 soldiers are stationed around my house. Many of them have jumped over the fence and they've taken control of my compound. I am not allowed to leave my house. And yesterday, my wife was trying to access the garden to get some food, and she was assaulted by soldiers. Journalists are not allowed to access me, and so are my party officials. They're not allowed to access me. I had to smuggle this phone into the house so that I can be able to get the word out there, because I know by getting the word out to the outside world, that is how I can be safe.
Honorable Bobby Wine, thank you very much. It's always so nice to speak with you.
Thank you, James Patrick.
Robert Chakulani, popularly known as Bobby Wine, was the presidential candidate of the National Unity Platform Party of Uganda. He was speaking with us from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. A spokesperson for the Electoral Commission of Uganda says the courts are open for all aggrieved candidates from last week's presidential and parliamentary election. This after main opposition presidential candidate Robert Chakulani, popularly known as Bobby Wine, has rejected results because of what he calls widespread illegalities and irregularities. Electoral Commission spokesperson Paul Bukenya says President Yoweri Museveni won the election convincingly.
We have declared the results of the presidential election, which was held on Thursday, and we've declared Yoweri Museveni Kaguta as elected president of the Republic of Uganda, having scored 58.64% of the total valid votes cast during the election. Or, if you put it in figures, 5,851,037 votes. Out of the total number of votes cast. The total number of votes cast, of course, being 9,978,093 votes.
What is the percentage for Bobby Wine and the opposition?
Chagulani Sentamu Roberts of the National Unity Platform scored 3,475,298 votes, representing 34.83% of the total number of valid votes cast in this election.
They have been concerned, Paul, about the transparency of the election.
I think the electoral process has been transparent from start to finish. The release of the program in 2018, which gave aspiring candidates enough time to prepare to participate in the election. And of course, the activities leading to the election, like registration of voters, which has took place called publicly and had participation across the country. The preparation of the register itself and the display, the nomination of candidates, where we had many candidates nominated at local government and parliamentary and presidential. And for the first time, 11 presidential candidates, the highest in the history of Uganda's election. And of course, the voting, which is done out there in the public with 34,684 polling stations, the vote counting, and now the process which is done involving observers at the district level and up to the national level. I think we've involved the participants and the participating political parties and candidates throughout the course of the exercise.
Bobby Wine is disputing the presidential election results.
Our laws provide that any person who has aggrieved any grievance or any complaints against the results that have been addressed or rather published can have their grievances addressed through lawful means, and the laws provide for that. So I hope if there is any questions about the results declared today, it will be presented to the necessary authorities through the legal channels that are provided for in our electoral laws.
Paul, thank you very much again. It's so nice to talk with you.
Welcome. Always a pleasure to talk to Voice of America.
Paul Bukenya is the spokesperson for the Uganda Electoral Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. Tunisian security forces arrested dozens of young people during consecutive nights of disturbances as the country marked the 10th anniversary of President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali's fall from power. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Arab media broadcast amateur video of crowds of young men setting fire and looting banks and private businesses in a second day of violence in a number of Tunisian cities. The Interior Ministry reported that 242 people were arrested in the wake of the violence. Prime Minister Hisham Mishishi said in a public address Saturday that he was presenting a ministerial reshuffle to Parliament to try and alleviate corruption, unemployment, and economic woes plaguing the country. He says that the coming months poses serious threat and reforms must be made to the economy, along with efforts to redress social injustice and underdevelopment. More cooperation
coordination is also needed at the ministerial level, he adds, and this is the reason for the decision to reshuffle the cabinet. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq, speaking to VOA from Tunisia, says the majority of the rioters were teenagers and young men, and that police have been reluctant to crack down on them due to criticism of brutality by various political parties. Sadiq notes that many Tunisians are not happy with the current situation, either economically or politically, and many feel that politicians don't care about the fate of ordinary people.
This model of the Arab Spring is facing a lot of difficulties despite all the Western media coverage and the image that this is a success. Inside the country, people are not feeling or seeing any success. They don't have bread, they don't have water. The security of the country is also problematic.
The government announced a four-day lockdown last week, saying the move was due to a surge in the number of coronavirus cases. Some analysts, however, say the lockdown was meant to prevent possible violence on the anniversary of the departure of former President Ben Ali on January 14, 2011. Tunisia has been facing serious economic problems in the years since the departure of Ben Ali, and the recent coronavirus crisis has left the country with a budget shortfall. Tunisians also say the government does not have enough money to buy enough vaccines for its population. The Arab Spring Revolution in Tunisia broke out in December 2010 after a young vegetable seller by the name of Mohamed Bouazizi set fire to himself to protest economic conditions and alleged police brutality. It was the first of revolutions across the Arab world in places like Egypt, Libya, Yemen, and Syria. Despite the overthrow of dictatorial governments like that of Zain al-Abidine Ben Ali in Tunisia in 2011, many of the demands and aspirations of protesters were never fulfilled, leading to periodic outbursts of public anger like the latest rioting and violence of the past several days. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, January 18. The Democratic Republic of Congo commemorated over the weekend the 20th anniversary of the assassination of President Laurent Kabila, who led the revolution that overthrew President Mobutu Sese Seko. Congolese also marked the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, who played a key role to end Belgian rule in the DRC. André Alain Atundu is an official of former DRC President Joseph Kabila's party.
This celebration is a moment to reflect for the people to think of the Moselle, as they called, what it did and what its legacy. Its legacy summed at this phrase, let's keep our own charge. Don't let the foreigner to help us, but we have to help us ourselves. What people recall from Mose assassination.
You talk about the legacy of the late Kabila. Some of the soldiers that killed him were recently let go or freed by President Tshisekedi. What is the current political climate in the DRC?
I think except this turbulence of the creation of l'Union pour la Nation, the political situation, particularly the celebration of this anniversary, is quite, I think it was a calm kind of reconciliation between Kabila family and Tshisekedi, because he was there as Kabila is a national hero. He was there by duty, of course, but it has a big meaning, political meaning.
You are also celebrating, I think, the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, a person that maybe many Congolese call the father of modern Congo. How are they remembering Patrice Lumumba there?
Today, the thing is the president, Tshisekedi, has decided to give a secretary for Mr. Lumumba, and we are waiting for the reparatization of his arrest. This is the most important thing. What were the rest of Patrice Lumumba will come back in Congo? But he didn't decide where he'll put on the earth.
It's said that Patrice Lumumba represents the unity of the Congo. On the 60th anniversary of his assassination, do you think the DRC is closer to some political unity, or do you think the country is far still too divided?
If this wasn't the reality, Congo would explode already by all these rebellion in the East Party, even in the Southern Party. I think the spirit of Lumumba is very strong, and it plays a key role in our national unity.
Andre Alain Atundu is an official of former DRC President Joseph Kabila's political party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. In Liberia, radio talk show host and political commentator Henry Costa says he will resist an attempt by the Liberian government to silence him over the airwaves. This after the government told the local Bushrod Radio not to host the Costa show, which is broadcast from the United States. Costa fled Liberia last year after the government issued a criminal writ for his arrest. The government says Costa is a fugitive and cannot host a radio show. However, Costa says there's no Liberian law prohibiting a person charged but not found guilty from speaking.
It is unlawful. It is unconstitutional. It is a feeble attempt at violating my constitutional right to freedom of speech and of expression. And more so, it is a blatant show of fear by the government. I think the government is really, really afraid of having me speak on radio in the country, which would afford me to speak to a larger segment of the population. I think that's what it is. And we're not going to accept it. We're going to resist it. There's no law whatsoever that states that if a person is charged or accused of anything by the government, and that person no longer has the right to be heard or to speak. It just doesn't make sense.
The government is saying that you are a fugitive who escaped being arrested for an alleged criminal offense against you, and therefore you should not be allowed to host a radio program from the United States.
Well, first of all, Mr. Borte, let's set the facts, put it in perspective. I was never charged by the government for any crime. And then this crime is that I forged a piece of document, a travel document, emergency travel document, which is not the case. They never charged me. They said they were doing an investigation. And they never charged me with anything. Then I left the country. And they tried to have me brought back into the country through extradition, which failed. So this is the latest attempt at trying to prevent someone who speaks to a large segment of the population from having access to the people using this platform. By the way, Mr. Borte, even if someone is charged and is in court, which is not my case, there's no law. The government does not have the authority, the executive branch at least, to take away somebody's constitutional right to freedom of speech and of expression. They don't have that authority. So what they're attempting to do here, which they will not succeed in doing, it's unconstitutional. That's what it is. Nothing else.
What about the argument that if you are allowed to broadcast from the United States and let's say you abuse that privilege or you injure somebody in terms of the dissemination of information, how would the government hold you responsible?
But listen, Mr. Borte, there's also no law that says that anybody outside the country cannot speak on radio. There's also another law that says you cannot do prejudicial or take prejudicial actions. The government would have to wait for me to commit a crime, either by incitement or to insurrection or incitement of any sort that would lead to violence, to someone getting maimed or property getting damaged, before the government can then prepare a charge to sue me. The government cannot say, suppose you commit a crime or suppose you incite someone in the future.
Political commentator and radio talk show host Henry Costa speaking with us from the United States. The Gambian government has imposed a ban on poultry birds and all poultry products from Senegal. This followed the outbreak of the highly pathogenic avian influenza bird flu in Senegal. As Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, Gambia's agriculture ministry says all efforts are being made to protect the country's livestock from the deadly bird flu virus.
The government said the ban on the importation of poultry products was intended to prevent the country from the deadly bird flu virus, as neighboring Senegal is currently witnessing an outbreak. Boubacar Sankano is a senior information officer at the information ministry.
The most important function of a government is to protect the lives and properties of its citizens, and then rather than acting in time to prevent something, rather than waiting until when it gets out of hand, we are already battling the COVID-19, which is affecting the human being, and the bird flu, which is affecting the livestock, and it's also so, livelihood for many people. We have to protect it, not just the citizens of the Gambia, but their livestock, their assets, you know, their properties, be it the hen, the chicken, the cow, and the donkey. We have to protect them as a government.
The ban was imposed by the Ministry of Agriculture in collaboration with the Ministry of Health and the National Disaster Management Agency, NDAMA. The Gambia relies heavily on Senegal when it comes to food supply, but Sankano isn't worried about food shortage.
No, there's no cause for alarm because, you know, the harvest season is there, you know, the crops arrive, you know, so we have enough food stock, you know, and we have varieties, not just we have enough meat. We have enough fish stock, you know, the fish stock is drying, and farmers are harvesting their crops. So, I mean, food supply is abundant in the country. So this controlling the chicken stock is good because it's going to protect the local stock.
The government has called on citizens to comply with the ban, saying that bird flu is a highly contagious viral disease. The government said the ban will remain in place until such time that the World Health Organization for Animal Health and the Senegalese authorities have confirmed the containment of the bird flu virus in Senegal. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with a look at the African Nations Championship, CHAN, which kicked off in Cameroon on Saturday, 1 year off its original schedule, occasioned by the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, approved up to 25% spectator attendance in the stadiums, provided that fans follow coronavirus regulations, and it will rise to 50% attendance in the knockout phases of the competition. The group matches will be played in the cities of Yaounde, Limbe, and Douala. FIFA President Gianni Infantino, who graced the opening ceremony on Saturday, applauded measures put in place to curb the spread of coronavirus in stadia following Cameroon's directive to allow only 25% of fans in the stadium.
I'm very happy to be in Cameroon to witness the kickoff of the CHAN, the first international tournament of the year, first national team game, beautiful opening ceremony today in Yaounde, in a stadium which was not full because of COVID restrictions, but still 25% of capacity was there, so it gave it a nice ambience, a nice atmosphere. It was very, very emotional to witness the ceremony celebrating Africa, and it's important to show to the world that we can organize such games in Cameroon, in Africa, to give hope.
The participating 16 teams are divided into four groups of four teams each, with the top two teams from each group advancing to the knockout stage of the tournament, which is strictly for local players who ply their trade in domestic leagues. Host Cameroon started their quest for the CHAN title on a high when they beat Zimbabwe 1-0 in the opening match of the Group A fixtures. Zimbabwe head coach Zebrako Lugarusik says COVID-19 impacted their preparations ahead of the tournament. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good day. And that's it for this Monday, January 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a very good week.